Welcome back to Rumblings from a Rambler. I'm Ron Verdicchio, your host. I'm speaking today with Professor Emeritus and author Dr. Tony Coletta about his new book, Reducing Anxiety and Difficult Behavior in Young Children, which is available on Amazon. Tony, in the previous broadcast, you spoke about anxiety and the school experience for young children. Can you tell our listeners what child anxiety is?
Sure, Ron. Anxiety in children is a worry about a future event, such as the possibility of a child or parent becoming sick or hurt, or the child not being able to perform in school and being embarrassed. Now, years ago, if you remember, parents and teachers called anxious kids worry warts or nervous Nellies. They kind of put them down. They told kids to get over it, suck it up. Today, we acknowledge that children do suffer from anxiety. It's a major problem, and parents and teachers and therapists can help them.
What classroom behaviors, Tony, do young children demonstrate that indicate that they are anxious?
Well, when children are anxious, they get jittery, their heart pounds. A child may get a stomach ache or a headache. Having a new sibling, or getting ready for bedtime when your room is a distance away from parents, even losing a teddy bear can create anxiety in young children. And as you know, babies experience stranger anxiety at 8 to 9 months. Separation anxiety begins as early as 12 to 24 months of age. We see anxiety in 3 to 7 year olds who may ask, will my mom forget to pick me up? Or will I be left alone in the dark? Is there a monster under my bed? Anxious children often ask the question, what if? What if I get lost? What if I get hurt? What if my mom has to go to the hospital? What if there's a bad man upstairs in my room? Anxious children may have difficulty sleeping or refuse to attend school.
Does social media have any effect on creating anxiety in young children?
Not so much on young children, say under the age of 8, but middle school and high school students suffer because of social media, and especially middle school students. They are constantly concerned with fitting in with friends and what is being said about them on Facebook or Instagram. According to Jonathan Haidt, social media is unregulated and has caused rates of anxiety and depression in adolescents to surge since 2010, especially in females. Social media exposes them to rumor spreading, bullying, distraction from schoolwork, and disrupted sleep, especially on Instagram. Instagram puts the size of their friend group on public display, and judgments of their physical appearance are subject to likes, dislikes, and comment counts. Studies show that cutting back on social media leads to less depression and better mental health for children. And Ron, I'd like to suggest that parents can purchase a phone. It's a special phone called a Gab phone, G-A-B-B, for children. Parental controls are not necessary on this phone because there is no access to the internet, no access to social media, and no addictive games. It just allows the children to text and make calls.
Well, this may be appropriate for young children, certainly. Can anxiety be a positive? Is there an upside to anxiety? And I'm thinking of a baseball pitcher who has to take a deep breath before pitching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there surely is a silver lining to anxiety. As I said earlier, a certain amount of anxiety is needed to keep us safe. Some anxiety is necessary and helpful because it encourages us to make preparations to protect ourselves. It reminds us to proceed with caution. Our brains are constantly scanning the world as we ask, is this dangerous? Will it hurt me? Should I fight? Should I flee? Should I freeze? Anxious feelings can also improve a child's skills because performance is heightened during anxious periods.
How is normal anxiety, which everyone feels at times, and I just said a baseball pitcher, for example, or a girl's softball pitcher taking a deep breath, how is that different from an anxiety disorder?
Well, therapists have a manual called DSM, D as in dog, S as in Sam, M as in Manny, It's known as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And it's a handbook for healthcare professionals that is a guide to diagnosing mental disorders. It lists 11 anxiety disorders such as post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, social anxiety, and panic disorder. Now, most kinds of anxiety, especially in children, focus on a specific worry. Things like separating from parents, angry dogs, spiders, clowns, or being left alone. When fear is exaggerated, this is called a phobia, which is considered an anxiety disorder. Now, some children may be anxious most of the time about many things, but none may be exaggerated. This is called general anxiety disorder, which is one of the 11 disorders. Now, quickly, Ron, when a child has an anxiety disorder, he or she may be unable to live a normal family life. These kids need professional help with therapists who use a technique known as cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And CBT aims at turning negative thoughts into positive thoughts. In cognitive behavioral therapy, used by professional therapists, children learn that having a thought does not mean the thought is accurate. Adults have 60,000 thoughts a day. Not all are worthy of concern. Children have a lot fewer thoughts, but a therapist will encourage a child to challenge an anxious thought which may be false or exaggerated.
What signals to teachers and parents the difference between normal anxiety and an anxiety disorder?
Good question, Ron. There are three words. Anxiety disorders are more frequent, have greater intensity, and are characterized by avoidance. Children with anxiety disorder will avoid any situation that creates anxiety. The big problem nationwide, however, is that 80% of children with anxiety disorders never get the treatment they need. Research shows that if anxiety disorders are not treated in childhood, depression and drug use could follow in the teen and adult years. So the strategies I want to discuss now provide teachers and parents with easy-to-learn tools to help anxious children until professional assistance, if needed, can be found.
Before you talk about the strategies, should treating anxiety in children be treated by mental health professionals exclusively? Or is there a role for teachers and parents to play?
Well, Ron, let me give you some self-disclosure here. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I was trained as a clinical psychologist and a specialist in the Army, but I am primarily, like yourself, an educator. Now, psychologists and psychiatrists tend to look mostly at unconscious behaviors, but educators, we deal with conscious behaviors. We suggest practical strategies and techniques that teachers and parents can use every day. And I believe that parents and teachers do not have to be therapists in order to do therapeutic things when dealing with normal anxiety. I think that knowledgeable teachers, parents, and family workers can intervene with helpful strategies before a problem gets worse or progresses.
Regarding strategies that parents and teachers can use, what is the number one strategy they should be thinking about to reduce anxiety?
Well, parents and teachers of young children should be aware of the important role that attachment plays in reducing anxiety. Let me repeat that deep attachment with loving adults is what shields children from anxiety. We are all creatures of attachment or togetherness. Attachment, along with thoughtful discipline, is the key to helping a child feel safe and secure. Children who face long periods of separation from those they are attached to become stressed. With today's young parents, 80% of mothers have to work full-time in order for the family to afford to pay high mortgages and rents. When they are home, parents need to put their phones away and focus on conversation, warmth, creative play, and behaviors that comfort children. In the family and the classroom, children thrive when attachment is secure. In fact, one study, Ron, found that the single most important factor in the mental health of children is the number of sit-down meals they have with the family. The more sit-down meals, the better the mental health of the family. So it's not the food, although you and I will agree that food helps. It's the togetherness that improves mental health and reduces anxiety. And if parents and teachers want to read a good book, it's called Hold On to Your Kids by Gordon Newfield.
Well, that certainly is a challenge in today's world with children participating in sports, siblings, doing other activities. Mom comes back from work. Dad may be working the second shift. So it is a challenge for the family to sit down. I think we all understand.
Absolutely,
that.
Yes.
So is there a strategy that helps parents make separation from young children easier?
Yes, I have several strategies for when parents separate. First, parents can create a ritual song that is sung just before separating. The song is a signal to the child that separation is near. A good example is a song called They Come Back, which can be downloaded off the internet. Second, have the child practice separating in short time periods, first 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then half an hour, and so forth. Third, talk to a child before separating and explain that you will be leaving soon. Sneaking out violates the bond of trust. As you know, a lack of parental reliability can lead children to develop mistrust in the later years. Fourth, remind the child, quote, even if I am not here, I am still with you. I am always thinking about you. Fifth, give the child an assignment before you leave. Quote, don't forget to show the new puzzle to the babysitter.
So then, what is the difference between anxiety and fear?
Well, anxiety is a worry about the future. Fear, on the other hand, is a reaction to a current event, such as a child getting too close to a large barking dog. By the way, Ron, what do you think is the biggest fear in adult women?
Spiders?
You're right. And how about adult men?
Well, I know what my fear is.
And what's that?
Fear of heights.
And that's it. That's the number one fear in men. Studies show that fear of insects is hardwired in many young children from thousands of years ago.
So let's turn to brain-based discussion for a moment. What is going on in the brain that triggers anxiety and fear?
Well, deep inside the lower part of the brain, or the primitive brain that developed a long time ago, is the amygdala. The amygdala detects emotions and triggers the fear response. The amygdala is always looking for potential harm. It's our alarm system that creates a fight, flight, or freeze response. When fearful, there is a surge of adrenaline in the body, increased blood pressure, and increased heart rate.
So what is the function of the amygdala?
The amygdala's job is to prepare the body to respond to an emergency. It's your protector. It saves lives and acts to keep you safe. Now think about it. You are crossing a snowy street. A car comes toward you and hits a patch of ice and is sliding right at you. Without any thought, just fear, a signal goes to the amygdala and you leap out of the way. So the amygdala is a lifesaver.
Does the amygdala do any problem solving that helps the child find a solution to an anxiety, Tony?
Anxiety is initiated in the amygdala, but it is the prefrontal cortex located in the front and top of the brain, in the upper part of the brain, that is responsible for higher levels of thinking, such as problem solving, making judgments, feeling empathy, and decision making.
So the amygdala and prefrontal cortex play a role in both creating and resolving anxiety?
Yes. The amygdala and the prefrontal cortex are the two pathways that initiate and resolve anxiety. The amygdala deals with emotions, the prefrontal cortex deals with thoughts. When you leave the house and you're not sure if you turned off the stove, the amygdala is triggered to worry and the prefrontal cortex thinks about solutions. The amygdala's alarm of a threat, however, may block the prefrontal cortex from thinking about the threat and seeing a solution. The amygdala usually triggers the fight, flight, or freeze response, which can override the prefrontal cortex.
Disclosure to our audience. I have that issue wondering whether I close my garage door or not when I pull out of the driveway. So it happens in adults as well.
Yeah.
So is there something called amygdala hijack, which I've heard about? What exactly is that?
Yes. If an overreactive amygdala sends an alarm of threat and the child's response is excessive, psychologist Daniel Goleman says the amygdala gets hijacked. An example is if a child accidentally hits a ball and breaks a window and then runs home, locks himself in the bedroom, cries and worries all day and all night, he will be sent to jail. The amygdala has been hijacked. There is so much emotion and anxiety, the prefrontal cortex is unable to think rationally. Now, the amygdala needs to feel safe in order for the prefrontal cortex to think clearly about the threat. When the amygdala feels psychologically safe, the prefrontal cortex is brought online so it can do its job. Now, Ron, one more thought about the prefrontal cortex. It is important to remember that the prefrontal cortex is the last area of the brain to mature. Now, of course, full maturity of the brain occurs in males by age 25 and in females by age 23. But we're talking here about preschool children and the maturation of that prefrontal cortex. It kind of doesn't mature till 6, 7, or 8. Now, children who are born as late bloomers or born prematurely or at low birth weight, possibly have ADHD or autism. In those children, the prefrontal cortex needs time and stimulation to develop. So they may benefit from delaying kindergarten for a year because it gives that prefrontal cortex time to grow and mature. Chapter 3 of my book, by the way, discusses this in detail with summaries of research supporting the extra year of growth.
Tony, is there any way, as parents and teachers, we can help children calm the amygdala?
Yes. Firstly, Ron, children tend to stay calm when adults are in control. So anytime there's a fearful event, an anxious event, it is important for us as adults to model calmness when there is upset around us. When children hear about violence, for example, please remind them that, quote, we will keep you safe, or, quote, we will help you. Our second anxiety-reducing strategy and the best way to treat an alarmed amygdala is to take slow, full, deep breaths. You push the chest out and the stomach out. Deep, slow breathing, our second strategy, will decrease activation of the amygdala. Breathing too quickly, known as hyperventilation, is ineffective. And, Ron, let me just tell you quickly about James Nestor's book called Breath. He created a breathing technique that I use every night. It's very, very helpful. It's called the 4-7-8 method. I'll discuss breathing for young children in a minute. This is for older children and adults, where you inhale through your nose slowly for 4 seconds and hold your breath for a count of 7 seconds, and then exhale through the mouth with a whoosh for a count of 8. And I do this maybe 2 or 3 minutes twice a day. Very, very helpful. Now, Nestor and Dr. Andrew Weil, among other doctors, state that breath control, deep, slow, intentional breathing, can lower anxiety, lower blood pressure, support heart arrhythmia, improve digestion, and get the body ready for sleep. Studies with Navy SEALs shows that deep, slow breathing is very helpful for them to reduce anxiety. And just quickly, for children in schools, particularly in preschool and primary grades, schools are using mindfulness techniques now. And one of them is called breathing buddies, where children lie on a mat, put a stuffed animal on their bellies, and they breathe out by pushing their stomachs out. And the stuffed animal rises. The children count 1, 2, 3 as it rises, and then 1, 2, 3 as it falls. And teachers who use breathing buddies say their children are calmer and more focused. A technique I use with my grandchild, my granddaughter, when she's stressed out or a little anxious, I give her a flower. I would just keep an artificial flower around. And I say, smell the flower. So she breathes in by pushing out her stomach and then blow the flowers out. And she breathes out.
Well, the first strategy you discussed was how to separate more easily from a child. And the second strategy, as we just discussed, was breathing to calm the amygdala. What's next? What's the third strategy?
The third strategy is called talking back to anxiety, which is a type of cognitive behavioral therapy strategy where children learn that just because they have a thought does not mean the thought's accurate. So it's important to learn to talk back to anxiety. Psychologists say that when thoughts are what set off emotions, children learn to reject, change, or reframe their thoughts. Then anxiety can be better managed. If anxiety could talk, it would say, "You can't handle this." When you teach children to talk back, the child learns to say, "Yes, I can handle it. You're wrong." Here's an example of talking back. After seeing a neighbor being carried away to the hospital by an ambulance and hearing someone say that could happen to anyone's mother, 6-year-old Susan begins to cry and says to her mom, "Are you going to go to the hospital too?" Mom helps the child talk back to her anxiety by asking her to repeat these words. Quote, "That's not true. My mom is fine. She is not going to the hospital." Parents and teachers can also use what is our fourth strategy, known as active listening, which is the ability to accept and reflect the expression of feelings in children without any judgment. In Susan's case, mom could actively listen by saying, quote, "I know you are worried that something bad might happen to me, but I am very careful and know how to stay safe."
Wow, very interesting. What else is involved in active listening?
Well, when a child is frightened and says, "I'm scared," instead of passing judgment by saying, "No, you're not, you're fine," try active listening. For example, say, quote, "Yes, you seem scared. Tell me what you're worried about." Now, if a child says to the parent, or the teacher, "No one at school likes me," adults usually say, "Well, that's not true." Now, this is confusing to a child who knows he is feeling rejection, and the adult is saying, "No, you're not being rejected." An accurate active listening response would be, quote, "So you are feeling rejected by the kids at school. How can I help?"
Why do you think that parents and teachers are often judgmental when children express their feelings?
Well, as parents and teachers, our first reaction is often to judge a child's feelings because it's hard to accept negative feelings. We do not want to give the feelings power. We don't want to diminish them. Now, here's another active listening example. Little Dan, 5 years old, a shy and worried child, said to his parents a week before his first day of kindergarten, "I don't want to get on that school bus unless the whole family comes with me." His parents were taken aback. They assumed he would enjoy the bus. Mom said, "But the bus driver will never allow all of us to go on the bus with you. And besides, you will love riding on the bus." And Dan yelled back, "No, I won't." So Mom then tried an active listening response and acknowledged and accepted Dan's feelings. She said, quote, "You're right. It can be scary to go to a new place without your family." Her son nodded in agreement. Take note that when a child's feelings are accepted, the child is relieved, just like adults. Children feel safe and supported when parents and teachers listen without judgment. Dan's mom then suggested that they visit the school and meet the teacher. On the night before the first day of school, they proceeded to cut out pictures of each member of the family and put them in a pouch so that Dan could, quote unquote, bring his family with him. The issue was resolved. No one wants their feelings judged, and everyone resents being told how they should feel. Now, Ron, let's just practice listening for feelings. So if a child says, "Will the germs make everybody sick?" Can you hear the child is saying, "I'm worried"? Or, "The virus is gone," you can hear the child saying, "You're relieved." Or the child says, "Those stupid train tracks, they always break," you hear frustration. Or, "The bus driver yelled at me and everybody laughed," the child was embarrassed. "Will I be left alone in the dark?" Nervousness. "I can't wait for vacation." Oh, you're really excited. "I hate you." You're angry. So it's important to learn to listen to and for the feeling.
And your fifth anxiety strategy?
The fifth one, Ron, is when parents and teachers preview a movie that's made for children and then proceed to prepare them for what is about to happen by talking through the scary scenes before they occur. So many movies today are just great for kids, but they have these scary monsters, and the kids need to be prepared to see them. After previewing, decide if the movie is too scary, will it create nightmares, and pick a different film. Also, it's important to go to a very good website called commonsensemedia.org. This website helps parents and teachers make good choices for what TV shows and movies children should watch.
There is great talk in the media and among parents about violence in TV shows and video games and movies for young children. How do those activities play a role?
Well, violent TV shows and movies can create anxiety in children unless adults prepare them for the violent scenes. And even then, parents and teachers need to assess if children are or are not ready to see a particular movie.
Why are some children so afraid of what is just animation, for example, a cartoon, something like that?
Yeah. Well, some children may worry that the monster or the scary figure on the screen will jump off the screen and harm them. We want children to be able to deal with scary images, but sensitive children could easily have nightmares by saying to themselves, what if the monster made of lava came after me? Between age 2 and 11, an average child in the United States has seen 8,000 murders on TV, and by age 18 has seen 200,000 acts of violence in the media. According to Dr. David Elkind, the famous developmental psychologist, quote, young children exposed to many hours of media and realities of life can easily become confused, fearful, and anxious. Researchers agree that video games foster more aggression in children than viewing TV violence because there is more active engagement in the violence.
Tony, what do professional associations say about media violence in children?
Well, the American Association of Pediatricians makes the following screen time recommendations. Number one, no screen time for children under 18 months. The second recommendation, 1 hour a day, ages 2 to 5. And the third one, consistent limits for ages 6 and older. Overall, parents should reduce exposure to screen violence and increase exposure to pro-social programs, which have been shown to increase positive child behavior. Examples of pro-social shows are Sesame Street, Dora the Explorer, Curious George, and Molly from Denali.
So like we discussed earlier in the broadcast that, you know, busy parents come home from work, pick their child up at after school care or daycare, and the temptation is to put that child in front of the screen while preparing dinner. And I'm referencing moms here, although that comment is also appropriate for dads. How do parents reconcile that? What would you recommend?
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation because parents especially, and certainly teachers who were parents, have so much to do when they come home. But, you know, life is all about priorities, Ron. So I'm saying to parents and teachers who know this already, but you've got to put young children first. The first 3 years are just the most important years in terms of overall development and especially brain growth. So we've got to make those sacrifices the first 3 years to spend more time with kids, not to just leave them in front of that TV set or on the iPad for hour after hour. The research is showing that too much screen time is just not good for the brain at all. So we've got to just prioritize and carve out time and be with kids, talk to them, play games with them, exercise with them, movement activities with them, and not just leave them in front of the boob tube for hours.
Thank you, Tony. I think that's really important for our listeners who are parents and teachers and others. And so we look forward to unpacking more strategies in the next part of the broadcast. I thank you for being with us today and sharing your insights. So in part 3, of this broadcast. I will continue my conversation with Professor Coletta, so please stay tuned. You've been listening to Rumblings from a Rambler, produced by Ron Verdicchio, recorded at Shared Universe Studios in Holmdel, New Jersey. This is a Two Adirondack Chair production. Children's background voices courtesy of Sound Factory, and music rights purchased from premiumbeat.com. Thank you for listening and stay tuned. We will see you shortly.